What's up, family? You are tuned into Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. From KPFA Radio and the Pacifica Network, I'm your host, Kat Brooks.
Our guest today is Maya Wind, a scholar of Israeli expertise and militarism. She is a Killam postdoctoral fellow in the Department of Anthropology at the University of British Columbia. Her book is Towers of Ivory and Steel, How Israeli Universities Deny Palestinian Freedom. Maya, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Maya, before I start my line of questions, because I actually want to go back in time, I think I need to set that up, though, with a summary from you. What is this book about, and what crossed your radar that led you to wanting to uplift this issue?
Right. So I'm a Jewish Israeli, and I'm also a scholar of militarism. So I've really spent many years researching how systems of violence, and specifically Israeli systems of violence, are sustained. And as I was making my way into higher education, I really came to understand how important it was to consider universities themselves as sites for sites that are central to these apparatuses of violence, and to really think about them as sites of power and as sites that themselves need to be interrogated. And so I sort of turned my critical gaze towards universities, specifically Israeli universities. And one of the things that really brought me to study them is the unbridgeable and the wide sort of gulf that exists between how Israeli universities are understood and narrated in the West, and specifically in the context of U.S. higher education, and how Palestinians understand Israeli universities. And so this book really seeks to try and address this gap.
Thank you for that. Okay. So I want to go back to 1918 with the establishment of Israel's first university, Hebrew University. In what way was and did its establishment serve, as you put it in the book, as a center for the formation of a new collective Jewish Zionist identity and nation?
Right. So one of the things that's important to understand about Israeli universities and the broader context of Israeli higher education is that from the outset, this was a political state-building project. So the Zionist movement, decades before Israel was even established, sought to found universities as part of their state-building, nation-building project. Hebrew University was the first of three universities that were established even before the Israeli state, so before 1948. And so Hebrew University, as you said, established in 1918, was conceived of by many leaders of the Zionist movement as an important institution that would help to give birth to a Zionist national collective identity. And also it would be an institution that would help the Zionist movement solidify its claims to historic Palestine, to Palestinian land. And so even if we're thinking about where they selected to build this university, it was built at the apex of Mount Scopus, which was at the time far removed from the center of Jerusalem as the city, sort of surrounded by Palestinian villages. And it was really to stake both symbolic and material political claim to the city of Jerusalem as the future capital of the state of Israel. And so this was really, even in the very location and the campus infrastructure itself, this was a land grab project. And this was a way for the Zionist movement to establish territorial domination over historic Palestine.
I want to go through two significant dates, starting with in the lead up to 1948 and the war and the Nakba. How were universities utilized to support its success? Talk about the Science Corps.
Right. So Chemed is the Science Corps of the Israeli military. And it really began as an underground operation back in 1946, led also by the Haganah, which is a leading Zionist militia at the time. And the Science Corps opened bases in the first three university campuses of the Zionist movement that were established at that time already, which was Hebrew University in Jerusalem, the Weizmann Institute in Rehovot, and the Technion, which was in Haifa. And so in the lead up and throughout the 1948 war, these universities actually came to anchor the research and development of the Zionist movement's military capabilities. So they actually played an incredibly important role in the Nakba, which was the mass displacement of the vast majority of Palestinians living in historic Palestine, and in the formation of the State of Israel. And the campuses really became, at the time, they actually came to serve as weapon manufacturing facilities. And so what you had is that faculty, students, staff really began to take over their campuses in rotating shifts. Some of the institutions were really put into operation 24/7, and they became the sites for the development and manufacture of weapons. One important story to share here is that Chemed's biological department, they had multiple departments, including a biological department, and this was actually led by a doctoral student at Hebrew University. And in 1948, they actually prepared typhoid dysentery bacteria to use as a biological weapon against Palestinians. And so this was used throughout the spring of 1948, both to prevent Palestinians from returning to their villages from which they were already expelled by Zionist militias. But later, in May of 1948, it was actually used to poison Palestinian communities where they were still living. So really as a mechanism of dispossession. And they did this in the aqueduct, in the water that fed Acre. And so, really, this was a use of a biological weapon to expel Palestinians and to help aid in the formation of the State of Israel. And so Chemed really came as a scientific enterprise that started as a Haganah militia initiative and then later became part of the Israeli military once that was formed after the State of Israel was established. And the Israeli universities, both pre-1948 and then the ones that were founded after, actually really played a central role in the continual development of the capabilities of Chemed. And so we really have this sort of military, academic, industrial complex forming already in those early days, and that has continued into the present moment, where Israel's leading military weapons manufacturers, Israeli military industries continue to be anchored and sustained by Israeli universities in the present day.
Yeah, and I was going to get us to present day. I do, however, want to talk about what was similar or different about Israeli academia complicity with the 1967 occupation of the Gaza Strip and West Bank.
What was different? Can you say more?
From 1948 to 1967, were there different strategies? Had strategies evolved, or was it the same?
Right. So if we think about Israeli state building, Israel actually has a state official project called Judaization. And this is really what Israel itself terms it. And this is really, if we understand it, this is actually a project that starts with the Zionist movement's attempt to colonize historic Palestine. And once a state was established, it then took a different shape and was called Judaization under this sort of the state rubric. But the Judaization is really a project of dispossession. It is a project to shrink the lands owned and inhabited by Palestinians. So it's a project to concentrate Palestinian population into ever smaller sections of land. And it is a project to expand at the same time Jewish-Israeli settlement and to disperse the Jewish-Israeli population as widely as possible to establish facts on the ground and to establish Israeli sovereignty in this way. And so this project that is a classic settler colonial project of displacement and replacement is a project that predates, of course, the Israeli state. It was from the outset the Zionist movement's project. But then with the establishment of the Israeli state, we really see how Israeli universities come to anchor this project regionally and actually play an incredibly important and often overlooked role in this Judaization program. So in my book, I look at several representative case studies, starting with Hebrew University that I mentioned previously, which really predates the state, and all the way to the most recently accredited and recognized Israeli university, Ariel University, which is actually in the illegal settlement of Ariel in the middle of the West Bank. And so in the book, I really trace how across these different localities, within 1948 borders, and then outside, as in the occupied Palestinian territories occupied in 1967, which is the West Bank, including East Jerusalem and the Gaza Strip, Israeli universities are really serving as sort of outposts to help seize land and claim land in areas where the Israeli state wanted to expand Jewish settlement. So we're seeing that, for example, Hebrew University post-1967 continues to expropriate land from its neighboring Palestinian village, Isawiyah, which is right adjacent to the campus, and as well as lands of other occupied East Jerusalem Palestinian neighborhoods. And it sort of expanded in, and it still serves as an important enclave for the Israeli state to claim East Jerusalem as part of its capital, even though, again, this is East Jerusalem is widely recognized by the international community and certainly in international law as occupied territory. And then we see this too across different locations. So in Haifa, which is a city in the middle of the Galilee, which is the region within Israeli state borders with the largest Palestinian population, which Israel was always incredibly concerned about, Israel establishes this university, University of Haifa, that then played a very instrumental role in the colonization of different Palestinian territories around the Galilee, really establishing new Jewish settlements in order to break up Palestinian territorial contiguity. Similarly, in the Nakab, which is the arid region in the south within 1948 borders, which was very sparsely populated by Jewish Israelis. Israel establishes Ben Gurion University in the 1970s in order to anchor new Jewish settlement and to try to incentivize Israelis to come move there and replace Palestinian Bedouins. And then the last example, which is really most recent, is Ariel University, which is really from the outset a project to help expand and legitimize the illegal settlement of Ariel as a permanent fact on the ground that cannot be removed. And Ariel is really a settlement, at this point now, a major Israeli city that is in the middle of the occupied West Bank. And Ariel University played an incredibly instrumental role in helping to legitimize and normalize this settlement and to bring new residents in. And this was entirely by design. The founders of the settlement of Ariel from the outset said, if we have a university here, it will legitimize this enterprise. We will get more people, more businesses. And you really see that is exactly what happened. And so in all of these examples, Israeli universities really served very crucial functions in land grab, in Palestinian dispossession, both within 1948 borders and in the occupied Palestinian territory.
You're listening to Law and Disorder. I'm your host, Kat Brooks, in conversation with Maya Wind about her book, Towers of Ivory and Steel, How Israeli Universities Deny Palestinian Freedom. Maya, I want to bring us into, more current context in terms of climate on Israeli campuses today. I want to start with having you talk about the ways in which they also serve or act as training facilities for Israeli soldiers, the types of curriculum that is offered and the rules around how Israeli soldiers must be treated once these universities are in contract with the state of Israel.
Right. So Israeli universities really have come to serve as training bases for Israeli soldiers. And this is in a number of ways, but one that you mentioned that is really important to understand is how they have come to understand their academic training and Israeli military training to be one and the same. And it really is remarkable. Right now, there are over 50 degree granting programs across all Israeli public universities to train Israeli soldiers for their positions. And so how that works usually is that soldiers are inducted, they go through basic training, they in effect are part of the system, they are active duty soldiers, and then they enroll in these degree granting programs in Israeli universities that are really designed to help train them for their positions. And some examples that we might, you know, particularly think about are two major ones, one that just recently opened just really this fall at Tel Aviv University called the Erez program. And this is a program that trains Israeli combat soldiers and specifically combat commanders through Tel Aviv University facilities. And so these soldiers go through basic training and then they enroll as soldiers in a specialized degree program at Tel Aviv University, where they study some courses alongside civilian students, but then some, they actually have military training in the guise of academic training on Tel Aviv University's campus. And Tel Aviv University, when it signed the bid with the Israeli Ministry of Defense to get this contract to train these soldiers, because it's very prestigious. It has Tel Aviv University got a lot of money from the state to host this program. This is actually accompanied with a whole list of conditions that the Tel Aviv University has to meet, including policing their own faculty and in stating new codes of conduct for their faculty. Example to note is a requirement that Israeli faculty at Tel Aviv University refrain from making any offensive statements about the Israeli military, about their soldiers, about their soldiers being in uniform on campus. And so this is just one of many examples where we're seeing that Israeli universities willingly collaborate with the Israeli military, with the Israeli Ministry of Defense, with the Israeli state, at the direct expense of the academic freedom of their faculty and students. And they're really subordinating their campuses to the needs of the Israeli state. And rather than fighting to preserve their independence from the state and from the systems of oppression against Palestinians. And so this is a really direct. These soldiers trained in the Erez program are later going to go be commanders of units in the occupied Palestinian territory. And so we all have seen and we all know now what kind of work they are doing. And so Tel Aviv University is really now even more deeply embedding itself and therefore is becoming even more complicit in the violation of Palestinian rights and in the current genocide in Gaza.
Maya, when given all of this context, what does this mean for Palestinian students that attend these universities? How are they treated, monitored, and how does that surveillance increase if a Palestinian student is suspected or actually engaged in organizing?
Right. So Palestinian students from the outset, from the state's founding, Palestinian citizens of Israel, that is, were surveilled and monitored and treated with suspicion. And Israel, from the earliest days, when Palestinian citizens were still under military rule, because it's important to remember that from 1948, when the state was established, through 1966, Palestinians who later would become Israeli citizens were themselves under military rule. And so during this time, Israel was incredibly concerned about educating Palestinians and granting them access to Israeli campuses because they were worried that they would be politicized and they could radicalize and be part of the movement for Palestinian liberation and agitate on their campuses. And so Israel established from the outset incredibly tight control over Palestinian students. And we see the afterlife of this to this day, and certainly in moments like this one, where Israel is actively engaging in an offensive on Gaza, the routine repression of Palestinian students is becoming even more overt. But I interviewed, in the course of writing this book, I interviewed and met with and accompanied dozens of Palestinian student activists, and I got to really hear their stories, and they were very generous in sharing their analysis with me, and telling me and about the kind of activism that they are engaging with, and the ways in which they are trying to reimagine the Israeli university as a space, and trying to challenge the restrictions that they are facing. And they're doing incredibly courageous work. They're really at the forefront of the movement for equality and freedom among Israeli citizens. And they are really met with the full force, not only of university administrative repression, but actually of the state repression. So university administrations routinely not only make it virtually impossible for Palestinians to organize by mounting a whole host of administrative and bureaucratic hurdles for them to have events, and for them to stage protests or vigils or anything like that on campus, but they also actually routinely call in the Shin Bet, which is the Israeli security agency, and Israeli police forces to come to campus and arrest their students. And so the Israeli university campus is not at all a safe space for Palestinian citizens of Israel, for Palestinian students. And Israeli universities make no effort to preserve their academic freedom and to make their campuses a space where Palestinian students and other critical students can engage in political education, can speak freely, can organize. And so again, we're seeing that the Israeli universities really just instead work alongside and with both the Israeli state and also Israeli far-right groups to actually restrict Palestinian expression. And we're seeing this right now on campuses in Israel. So just since October 7, several dozen Palestinian students have been suspended. Others have been called into disciplinary hearings. Many of them have been accused of incitement and support for what Israel considers terror, right? And so they're now facing really impossible conditions. Many Palestinian students have said they are not planning to return. The new academic year just began at the end of December. It was delayed because of the offensive on Gaza, and many Palestinian students chose not to return at all to their campuses because of fear. And just to put it in perspective, the National University Student Association of Israel put out a call to universities to prepare military squads to protect students from, again, what they understand as Palestinian, what they claim as Palestinian terrorism, and actually called on the Israeli government to enact emergency regulations on campuses to purge what they consider support for terrorism, which they are now policing their fellow students, combing through their online expression and going to tell the administrations in order to suspend their fellow students. And they actually, even the National University Student Association, even called for the Israeli government to enact a emergency regulation, right? And to really to curb student expression. So imagine, while we're seeing this agitation across university campuses across the world, including the United States, of students organizing for justice in Palestine and a ceasefire, at the same time, the Israeli Student Association is actually calling for the government to intervene, to have more repression, and to help them repress their fellow students from similar agitation.
Maya, before this current round of genocide, wherein Israel has literally bombed all of the universities in Gaza, Palestinian universities in Gaza, what universities existed and what kind of control did the state of Israel exercise over them?
Yeah, there is currently no higher education in Gaza, right? So all 12 institutions of higher education in Gaza have been either damaged or entirely destroyed. We have all seen images and in some cases videos released by the Israeli military itself of Israel blowing up and completely destroying Palestinian universities. It started with the Islamic University and Al-Azhar University, and now the most latest one was Israel University. And so we really... Israel has intentionally and utterly destroyed the infrastructure of Palestinian higher education in Gaza. At least 94 academics have been killed. Over 4,300 students have been killed. 60% of bookshops and libraries have been destroyed. So really, Israel has really just brutally destroyed the infrastructure of higher education in Gaza and in this last offensive. But this has a longer history, right? This did not start today. This is just the latest and most brutal iteration of a much longer, decades-long process. So Palestinians before the establishment of Israel were free to enroll in universities across the Middle East, and many of them did study. They studied in universities in Beirut, in Damascus, in Cairo. And then actually the Palestinian higher education system in the occupied Palestinian territory was actually founded because of the occupation, because Palestinians were then became severed from the rest of the Middle East, and they came under Israeli military control, and so they could not travel anymore for education in leading universities, not only of course in the Middle East, but also in Europe, in the United States, and elsewhere. And so they were forced by Israeli military governance to establish their own educational system. And they did so under conditions that are just unimaginable and in the face of severe oppression by the Israeli military government. So the first university to open in the occupied Palestinian territory was Bir Zeit at the outskirts of Ramallah in the West Bank. And since then, there have been dozens of universities opened across the West Bank, including East Jerusalem and in the Gaza Strip. And as soon as these institutions opened, the Israeli military government made sure to make it virtually impossible for them to do absolutely anything. They regarded these universities as sites of fomenting national liberation ideas, and they were really intent on suppressing them. And so we're really seeing this is a decades long history of routine invasions of campuses, of the murder and abduction of Palestinian students and faculty, torturing Palestinian student activists and holding them in administrative detention without charge or trial, and the incredible restrictions on movement, on the on books and equipment needed for these universities. And this is true both in the occupied West Bank, including East Jerusalem, and in the Gaza Strip. And so we're seeing a whole host of very serious restrictions that the Israeli military has put into place to really stifle and repress Palestinian higher education. And this is what Karma Nabulsi and others have described as scholasticide. And I think this is a very accurate term to describe what we are seeing, which is really just the intentional decimation of the Palestinian right to education by the Israeli state.
You're listening to Law and Disorder. I'm your host, Kat Brooks, in conversation with Maya Wind about her book, Towers of Ivory and Steel, How Israeli Universities Deny Palestinian Freedom. Maya, I want to move on to talking about the relationships between Israeli universities and universities in the West, and what kinds of partnerships exist. What have those looked like, and how have they validated the Zionist state of Israel?
Right. So one of the things that is really striking, and we're seeing this now with the Western narration of the genocide in Gaza too, is this sort of uncritical parroting in mainstream Western outlets of Israeli narratives. And we see that play out in the context of higher education as well, where Israel has continually asserted that its universities are somehow bastions of democracy, of free expression, of academic freedom. And the overwhelming majority of Western educational institutions just simply take them at their word. And then you have these institutions like the U.S.-based Freedom House and other parallel institutions in North America and in Europe just sort of asserting that, you know, as Israel does, or sort of mirroring the Israeli assertion that somehow Israeli universities are free. And on this basis, they have established an incredible network of research collaborations, jointly funded programs, student exchanges, right? So dozens of universities across the United States and North America and with large and Europe have exchange programs for students to study at Israeli universities, often when they have no such parallel programs at any Middle Eastern university, right? Or any other university anywhere else in the Middle East. And so we're really seeing this exceptional status being conferred on Israeli universities as somehow exceptionally free, exceptionally democratic, and therefore worthy of these kinds of exchanges, where Middle Eastern universities are not granted this kind of status in the West. And so this is part of the legitimizing operation, and this is part of through Israeli universities, the Western academy is also legitimizing the Israeli state. And crucially, it's also erasing and ignoring what Palestinians have not only said, but have meticulously documented over decades, right? So Palestinian scholars, Palestinian citizens of the Israeli state who are scholars of education and others have researched and published an incredible body of work on the experience of Palestinian citizens of Israel within Israeli universities, both what it is like to be a student and a faculty member, and the kinds of restrictions on pedagogy, on teaching, on research, on discourse. This research exists. It is completely ignored by Western academic institutions. And it also completely ignores what Palestinians, civil society and scholars, including university student and university faculty unions from within the occupied Palestinian territory, are saying, which is they are documenting, as are human rights organizations, both Palestinian and international, are documenting the routine and systematic repression of the Palestinian right to education under Israeli military governance, and how Israeli universities are complicit in this. And specifically in academia in the West, there is none of this, right? So they just completely ignore this incredible body of research and scholarship conducted by Palestinians, and continue to confer this exceptional status on Israeli universities. And so this is really a way that the Western institutions continue to legitimize the Israeli state and to normalize it, and in so doing, they normalize Palestinian repression.
Well, let's stay there for a second, because when you look at what is happening now in this current moment of genocide, where American universities are targeting and firing faculty members who speak out against the genocide, expelling students and allowing targeting of them and Palestinian activists on campus. Your thoughts?
Right. And so I'm so glad that you're bringing this up, because this is exactly, I understand it to be a continuation of the war on Palestinian education, right? And on Palestinian freedom. So it's happening on Palestinian campuses, it's happening in Israeli campuses, and it's extending into the United States through the Israeli state and Zionist lobby groups who are even toppling university presidents, right? And who are silencing students and faculty who want to speak out for Palestinian freedom and against the genocide. And this is all part of the same system that is trying to silence our movement, the movement for Palestinian rights. And so what we're seeing play out, I think, on university campuses in the United States is really a mirror and an extension of what is happening in Israel and in occupied Palestinian territory. And we have to understand it as part of that same system and that part of that same problem.
Can you... I want to talk about the BDS movement and its inclusion of Israeli sites of higher learning in the boycott demand, as well as how Israeli academics responded.
So the overwhelming majority of Israeli academics have responded to the call for the academic boycott issued by the Palestinian civil society back in 2004. It was actually the very first call of the BDS movement was the call to hold Israeli universities accountable. And the overwhelming majority of Israeli academics have responded over the last two decades of Palestinian mobilizing for freedom and to hold Israeli universities accountable with sort of indignant opposition and sort of flat denial, denial that they have anything to do with the with the denial of rights of Palestinians. And they routinely say, Israeli academics, in response to the call for boycott, you know, this is the Israeli state. This has nothing to do with us. This has nothing to do with our universities. Why are you holding us accountable for this? Again, despite the fact that the complicity of their institutions is not only known to them, it's very well documented, certainly in Hebrew, it's very well known. But so in the international community, they just totally deny this, their complicity. And I think it is a real shame because I, as an Israeli citizen and as an academic, I'm incredibly inspired by the BDS movement, by the call to boycott and to hold institutions accountable. And one of the things that we really need to understand, and I think this is also what the Israeli state and the Zionist lobby tries to frame the BDS movement as punitive. This is not a punitive movement. This is a movement for liberation. And what the BDS movement is doing, not only in calling for the boycott and in turning to the international community, is calling for accountability. And what it is offering Israelis as well is a roadmap. So Israeli universities, you know, should not be, they need not be part of the system. They need not be embedded with the state. They need not repress their Palestinian students and faculty and help manufacture weapons to repress Palestinians and help produce scholarship that legitimizes the Israeli occupation and produce expertise for the Israeli security state. And it need not do any of these things. Israeli universities can absolutely hold themselves to account and disentangle themselves from the Israeli state, from its apparatuses of violence, and be part of the infrastructure, become part of the infrastructure of the movement for freedom for both Palestinians and Israelis. And I think that what the Palestinian civil society has explicitly done is call and invite Israelis of conscience to join the movement, for liberation, and to participate. And so I think that what Israeli academics fail to understand is, and to fail to recognize, is what an incredible gift the BDS movement is offering them, which is a roadmap to ethical participation in a movement, and to really to take responsibility and accountability for our status as settlers, and instead, you know, become part, you know, join the movement to liberate for freedom for everyone. And so I hope that we can that people in the United States who are hesitant about the academic boycott can understand this not as a punitive movement, but rather as an invitation, as an opportunity for not only Israelis to participate, but also for all of us across higher education. People are feeling incredibly frustrated and helpless seeing the Biden administration send Israel more weapons, block votes in the United Nations, and people are feeling really helpless about how deeply embedded and complicit the U.S. government is in this genocide. But actually, we have a lot of power. The universities are incredibly important sites of power, which is also why the Zionist lobby is so intent on silencing dissent on U.S. campuses. And so I think one of the inspiring things about the academic boycott is that it offers all of us in higher education institutions in the West, in particular, the opportunity to participate in the movement and to take a stand and to sever our ties with Israeli universities as a way to put pressure on Israeli society and on the Israeli state to end the genocide and to grant Palestinian freedom.
The foreword of your book, Maya, is by Nadia Abu-Lahaj, and it begins by making the case that Israel is not a democracy and cannot be because its existence is predicated on the subjugation, exclusion, and, if you will, extermination of Palestinians. Why is this an important premise to understand for this conversation about Israeli academia and its role in the creation and implementation of the Zionist state?
Yeah, I think it is really past time in the United States and in the West to really address head on the core of the problem, which is that fundamentally the basic principles of democracy are fundamentally at odds with the premise of an ethnocracy and a Jewish state in Palestine. And those are fundamentally at odds and they cannot be reconciled. And so the Palestinian movement has for decades, of course, really since the establishment of the Israeli state, if not before, really staged their opposition and to the Zionist project of a Jewish state in Palestine on these grounds, and have said repeatedly, there cannot be a democracy as long as Palestinians are relegated to the status of second class citizens at best within the Israeli borders, and to subjects governed by military occupation in the occupied Palestinian territory, and of course, as long as Palestinian refugees who are in the diaspora now and have been displaced by the Israeli state are not allowed their right to return. So what is really happening, I think, now more and more as the Palestinian BDS movement gains traction around the world and particularly now in the West, is that we are finally talking about the fundamental issues that have been sort of either ignored or sidelined or silenced until now. We were talking about, military occupation. Then finally, we were able to talk about apartheid. And now what we're really finally getting to is the fundamental conversation about Israeli settler colonialism and the fact that the Israeli state is really premised on the displacement and replacement of Palestinians, and that there cannot be true liberation for Palestinians, but not even for Israelis. There cannot be true freedom and democracy as long as this is the mode of governance by the Israeli state. And so what we're really looking at now is, I think, a conversation in the U.S. campuses too. What does decolonization look like? And what needs to happen for everyone to be free and for everyone to live with equal rights? And it's finally, that conversation is finally taking place in much wider circles than was previously allowed. And I think that the backlash that we're seeing on college campuses is a direct response to that conversation finally expanding into more and more mainstream circles in the U.S. university system and outside it too.
Maya Wynn, what is your hope for this book in the world? And has that hope shifted or grown? Because you wrote this before this latest siege, but now we're in the middle of it.
It is very hard to be hopeful at this moment. I think I keep thinking back to my years of education under the Israeli educational system, and how much we were taught about genocide, about the genocide that our own families went through, my own grandparents included. And a question that we kept returning to again and again at school as children was, how did the world allow this to happen? How did the world stand by? And how did people come to dehumanize Jewish communities to the point where they could commit this genocide against them? And I keep returning to this question now as I'm seeing my own society, the community that raised me, participate in a genocide. And in the devastating dehumanization of Palestinians to the point where we are starving them, depriving them of water, of access to the most basic of medical care, and of course, bombing them and killing thousands and thousands of Palestinians, including an unimaginable number of children. So it is hard in this moment to feel hopeful in sort of facing the kind of just truly devastating, horrific, unimaginable violence that we are all witnessing now. But I do find hope in Palestinian students, in Palestinian academics, who are the most courageous advocates and who continue both on their own campuses in Palestine and in Israeli campuses against all the odds and under the most unimaginable and inhumane conditions to insist on their right to education, on their right to freedom. And I'm also heartened that their calls are being heard more and more. And you're seeing now, I think, a groundswell of support for the BDS movement, for the academic boycott across places where they weren't as much. So specifically, you know, I'm based in North America, and where the educational system has been overwhelmingly repressive of advocacy for Palestine and still continues to be. But what we're seeing now is that there is just such a surge in organizing by both faculty and students across North America, across Europe. And I think that it cannot be ignored and we cannot be stopped. And my hope is for this book to be a resource to that organizing and to provide more data, much of which was I sort of translated from Hebrew that was not accessible previously to a lot of the international academic community, and to really provide the evidence for the case of why we need to boycott and hold Israeli universities accountable because of their deep and systematic complicity in these systems of violence and repression against Palestinians. And so I get so much hope from both the strength and power of Palestinian organizing and also the extent to which it's being met now with mass mobilization across campuses all over the world.
You have been listening to Law and Disorder. I'm your host, Kat Brooks. Our guest today has been Maya Wind, a scholar of Israeli expertise and militarism. She is a Killam postdoctoral fellow in the Department of Anthropology at the University of British Columbia. Her book that we've been discussing today is Towers of Ivory and Steel, How Israeli Universities Deny Palestinian Freedom. Maya Wendt, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me, Kat. It's been a real honor.
You've been listening to Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. That's it for this episode, family. You can find more information about topics and guests in this episode's show notes. Law and Disorder is produced at KPFA. That's listener-supported radio on the Pacifica Network. The show is produced by Jesse Strauss and hosted by me, Kat Brooks. Our theme music was composed by Steve Raskin of Fort Knox 5. If you like what you heard, please follow us on social media at Law and Dis, that's D-I-S, and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. Feel free to holler at us about something you heard or send us a show idea at lawanddisorder@kpfa.org. You can also find our content live at 8 a.m. weekdays on KPFA. That's 94.1 FM in the Bay Area. Our show and all of KPFA's programs are funded exclusively by you, the listener. And if you're in a position to support us, please donate today at kpfa.org. Take care of yourself and take care of each other. We all we got, fam.